Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The famed Boston Marathon ended abruptly just before 3 p.m. yesterday in a moment of explosions and pandemonium. Now the country is looking for answers. Who? Why? How? And what does it all mean for cherished days of public celebration when the blasts of a moment fill a city's streets with horror? This hour On Point, the investigation, impact, and implications of the Boston Marathon bombings. You can join us on air or online. Have you run this race? Watched its joy? What were you thinking yesterday at the news? Were you there at the finish line and its blast? Join us anytime digitally at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. This story, of course, hits home for us at On Point. People walking out of the blast zone were streaming by our studio in Boston yesterday. Here's some sound of an unidentified man after the explosions at the Boston Marathon finish line.
We've had an attack.
And spectator Hannah Truslow here in the stands directly across from the explosion.
We're in the VIP seating. There's Lakawachi across the street. We saw the first bomb go off and people, blow up in the streets and then the one further down.
And here's the sound of the Boston Police Department scanner directly, immediately after the explosions.
Units, stay off the air. Units, stay off the air. Just make your way over there. All units, stay off the air and make your way over there.
Help up from the medical tent. Get as many people up here as you can from the medical tent.
As we speak today, three dead, 160, maybe more injured. Boston Marathon spectator Amir Razavi from San Francisco said he could not understand what would motivate such an attack.
I don't know why anyone would do something like this. Just take something so pleasant and turn it so horrible. It's unbelievable. What goes through people's minds, it's sickening. It really is.
12 blocks in the center of the city, still a crime scene as we speak. Joining me right now from Cambridge, Massachusetts, across the river from downtown Boston, is Juliette Kayyem, professor at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. She is former Homeland Security Advisor to Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick, former Assistant Secretary for Intergovernmental Affairs at the Department of Homeland Security under President Obama. She writes on national security and foreign policy for the Boston Globe. Juliette, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Tom.
What do you make of the shape of this apparent attack?
Well, I probably don't have many more clues than anyone else, although I've been spending the night on the phone. I think we don't know right now is the honest truth. I think that the signs are cutting in many different directions. The sort of fact that it wasn't a very sophisticated bomb, it appears, may point to homegrown. On the other hand, it may have been detonated by cell phones. That suggests more sophistication. I would think right now that a lot of signs are leaning towards a more local, maybe domestic attack for a number of reasons. One is the Boston Marathon, while it's a global event, is really quite local. I mean, it doesn't have the feel, say, of a Super Bowl or another major sporting event. And also the fact that no one has taken credit for it. I just was listening to the press conference of all the public officials. They are going in every direction to determine, to make sure they don't close off any doors where it leads. And there's a lot of evidence, Tom. I mean, there's the forensic evidence there. There's the cameras. There's the pictures. There's the video surveillance. And there is, I do want to say, there's a pretty pristine crime scene. I know that sounds strange given the pictures that we saw. But one of the best moves that the responders did early on, which they obviously had to do, but they did it in such a calm manner, was to get the runners away from the crime scene onto Commonwealth Avenue. So people who don't live here, it's just a sort of parallel street. What that meant was that the crime scene was closed relatively quickly once you got the victims out. And so there's probably a lot of evidence there, that, and we know that they're culling through it. So in some ways, that response really is going to help the investigation.
We're going to speak with an explosives expert in this hour about what was witnessed yesterday and what that evidence may yet tell investigators about what happened in Boston at the near the finish line. Juliet Kime, please stand by. This morning, a big press conference in Boston on the latest in the investigation. My colleague, WBUR reporter David Boeri, was there and joins us now from Copley Square near the site of yesterday's explosions. David, welcome. What have we learned?
We've learned, Tom, this morning, and perhaps we didn't need to know it, but we were reassured that this is going to be a full, all-out investigation, one of the biggest crime scene investigations, the biggest crime scene investigation in the history of the Boston Police Department, and certainly one of the biggest in national history. A 12-square-block area has been secured. The press conference, Tom, was more in the nature of inspiring the public that, in fact, there were great acts of bravery, of assuring the public that there's going to be a thorough investigation, and the resolve that, as one of the speakers, the district attorney here at Suffolk County said, the coward or cowards who did this will be brought to justice.
David, at the press conference and beyond, you've been following this. What do we know at this point about leads and lines of investigation?
Tom, I want to qualify this because as somebody who covered 9/11, I'm acutely aware of the fact that a lot of information and reports in the first day, the first hours, the first days were flat out wrong. So I want to qualify what I'm about to tell you, and yet I will tell you that reliable sources have told me that one person in the hospital, a Saudi national, had burns on his hands that were considered unlike the other injuries. So they were not, his injuries were not consistent with the injuries of others that were being brought in. As a result of that, I am told, investigators went to Revere, the town next door to Boston, the city of Revere. They went to an oceanside apartment, a high-rise apartment, and there they found an apartment that had three roommates. One of them, of course, was the one that was hospitalized. A second person there, another Saudi national, had a visa problem. I am told, again, by reliable sources, that he was taken into custody. Now, again, Tom, we need to qualify this because in the early hours, investigators want to make sure they have all bases covered. So he's not being charged with the bombing itself. He's been taken into custody. They described the apartment as an apartment of transients. There's a third person, apparently in New York. They were looking for him. Perhaps they found him. I do not know. But they were looking for a third person. All Saudi nationals living in an apartment on a short-term basis. They apparently were preparing to leave the apartment. Their lease was up, or the short-term arrangement was up, and they were headed out. So that's what we have at this point. Again, Tom, you know, it's what's interesting from 9/11, Boston was the crime scene it was the crime with no scene here. Much unlike 9/11, there is a crime scene. It's being worked. And by the way, I got to tell you, there's one other thing that struck me. As opposed to 9/11, when there were many, many photographs, thousands of photographs, now in the social media age, that's been multiplied. They figure there are hundreds of thousands of videos, photographs taken yesterday, and they want to see them.
Of course, we need to treat all this, as you say, David, with extreme caution at this point. It's easy to weave a fabric of narrative out of not enough to really know. Boston Globe reporting that this person was reportedly tackled and held by a bystander after he was seen running from the scene of the explosion. But he said, look, he was just running to get away. And investigators with the Globe, David, did not characterize the Saudi national as a suspect.
Yeah,
and yet, you know, there are all these impressions, of course, that people have, suspicion, somebody running. What does it really say? And I'm keenly aware of this, Tom, and telling you with I have learned from reliable sources inside the investigation.
And so, and what about the witnesses to the explosion itself and the the smoke, the flame, the understanding at this point, David, of the explosive devices?
What I'm told, and again, I know that you have an explosive expert that's coming on to talk mm-hmm. to you. What I've been told in that regard is that if there are two suspects in this were smokeless gunpowder, a substance, by the way, that you can buy over the counter in most states, smokeless gunpowder. Others are pointing to a C4 explosive. One, again, reliable source, called one of the devices anyway, a small homemade bomb. The press conference, Tom, has revealed, it's been stressed once again, that there were only two explosive devices, contrary to top rumors, reports that there were others. In fact, there are only two they believe they have.
There were reports of that there was no shrapnel in the bombs themselves, and then others saying maybe BBs or nails. Any further clarification on that front?
Well, now, Tom, we get to a much lower standard here for me to report. One police officer said to have seen ball bearings on the sidewalk. You know, the evidence of that, whether there were ball bearings or not, will be the hospitals, whether they're removing that shrapnel from people they've been operating on. And others say they're not aware of that.
And, of course, an 8-year-old boy, the third to die today, watching his father complete the race, David.
You know, it was eerie, and it reminded me again of the day after 9/11, Tom. A beautiful day, warmer than expected, and yet on Newbury Street, on the streets parallel to Boylston Street, there were lots of people in running suits, obviously people that had run the marathon, strolling on the sidewalk, and yet the streets were still in the shadows of tall buildings, and it added a particular eeriness to it all.
A day of joy, a beautiful day, and then suddenly these blasts. David Boeri with NPR news station WBUR joined us from Copley Square near the site of the blasts yesterday. David, thank you very much for being here.
You're welcome.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about the bombing of the Boston Marathon, blasts at the finish line, and a sea of unknowns. We're looking at the investigation, impact, and implications of this attack yesterday for the city, for the country. So many cameras trained on this yesterday, and then so many microphones brought out to talk with those who had just witnessed the explosions. Here's soldier Jeff Curtis. He was 50 yards from the explosions near the finish line at the Boston Marathon and ran to help victims yesterday.
We're picking them up, putting pressure on wounds. A lot of people were hurt. We just threw them, ran as fast as we could down here to get blood. They were banged up bad. Severe lacerations, amputees, a lot of shrapnel. You know, they were pretty big explosions.
And here's spectator and Ben Myers, who was with his wife and child at the site of the Boston Marathon bombings. He talked with On Point producer Dean Russell shortly after the explosion, describing what he saw.
It wasn't until people saw the smoke rising up that people understood. And then when I could smell the gunpowder, I could smell the sulfur and smell the gunpowder, I knew it was something more. It was big enough so that you could feel it. Like there was a visceral sort of shockwave in the air and through your feet. It was like the biggest sort of explosion I'd ever felt.
A visceral shockwave in the air and through your feet. Juliette Kayyem is with us. She's former Homeland Security Advisor to Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick, columnist for the Boston Globe now. We'll hear in just a moment from an explosives expert. Juliette, here we are again, one of these situations where you've got information coming in, you have things pouring in, this assertion, that assertion, it is so hard to sort out.
Yeah, so I mean, and based on the assertions about the Saudi group, I want to make it clear, people in investigation, some people know a lot, some people know a little, and so there's a reason why in the press conference that just ended there would be either no discussion or actually a refutation of certain rumors, in particular ones that might be tied to foreign links in which we might be doing investigations abroad, and that is because you don't want to screw up the investigation, or sorry for saying screw up, but you don't want to mess it up.
Mm-hmm.
And so So the idea, a lot of these rumors get started because people actually don't know that something has been closed, some train has been closed, or some line of inquiry has been open. And so that's why I think you're hearing, and based on the previous guest, you know, that all of this is just rumor, myth, and what we really need to do is just let the investigation unfold. It's not because government likes secrets. They do like secrets. That's true. It's because there's still some people out there who did a horrible, horrible thing. And the more that they know what we know, the more likely it is that they're able to get away from law enforcement efforts. So that's probably why you're hearing all this stuff. I mean, just even from yesterday, right? So we thought that there were 7 detonating explosives. There weren't. There were only 2. Mm-hmm. We thought something happened at the Kennedy Library. It didn't happen. It was only at the marathon event. And so we thought this woman or this Saudi at the hospital was under arrest. No, she actually was a victim. So all of those things get unfolded. So that's why we sort of have to look at the response, which I think was just is really incredible. I mean, there were so many things done that I think did protect this criminal.
From all the medical staff there, from all the security officials, from all the bystanders who rushed to help.
You've seen the end of the marathon. I've lived the end of the marathon, and it's a it is a public health event. And the strange and good coincidence is that you just had a lot of doctors, you had a lot of triage, and we have great hospitals here, and so that clearly just saved a lot of lives. As we're seeing that the numbers are, fortunately, knock on wood, not increasing from the 3 we had of this morning. So you had a lot of also, you know, good coincidences as well. But you know, I did security for the Boston Marathon. It is really hard. You know, it's not really 26.2 miles, it's 52.4. It is
both sides of the street,
right?
Yep.
It is an open event, and that's what we love about it. The finish line is secure because we have a lot of public officials there. That's why I think this idea that someone may have come in the more casual aspects of the marathon, which is family reunification, the finish line.
This is after the big pros have done their spectacular times. Yeah, but thousands more still coming.
Right, but this was not the elite runner. So I think, you know, that makes some people I've been talking with makes them think that this is someone who also knew the marathon and maybe knew the area. So.
Where the crowds would be, how long they would linger. Juliet Kine, please stand by. I want to bring Jimmy Oxley into this conversation from Kingston, Rhode Island, professor of chemistry at the University of Rhode Island. She's also co-director of the Department of Homeland Security Center of Excellence in Explosive Detection, Mitigation, and Response, and co-director of the Forensic Science Partnership of the University of Rhode Island. Jimmy Oxley, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
You, like everybody around the country, perhaps around the world at this point, has probably seen again and again video of the explosions, the 2 explosions near the finish line at the Boston Marathon yesterday. From what you've seen, from what you've read, from what you know, Jimmy, how are you interpreting what we've seen there and heard?
Well, I guess the first interpretation was that it was probably a relatively small device that could fit in a backpack, especially since later reports came out it was in a trash can. But the size of the plume that you can see in the pictures, narrowing it down from just photographs to what was actually used would be extremely hard. Your guest, I believe David, mm-hmm. had suggested smokeless powder, and that's certainly a possibility. It's purchasable in this country, very available to reloaders. But he also suggested the complete other end of the spectrum, which was C4, which is a military material.
Plastic explosives.
Yeah, not nearly so available. In between those two, there are a lot of materials available that nowadays get termed homemade explosives. And that means that a person could make those explosives from readily available materials, if he had the knowledge. And we have the internet to teach us and YouTube to show us in detail how to do those things.
Better or worse, yeah. Hey, Jimmy, I want to ask you, we've all seen and heard this too many times, but I want to listen one more time just to get your sort of audio interpretation. This is the sound of the second blast from an eyewitness video near the marathon finish line yesterday.
Michael.
Okay, we've all heard it. Does the sound itself tell you anything, something, anything at all, Jimmy?
I'm sorry, it really does not. I've heard a lot of blasts, and of course you spend your time trying to protect your ears if you're in this business when you're doing one on purpose, but I'm sorry, I don't have an opinion on the sound of the blast.
The nature of the wounds, many of them low, the amputations, and there have been a sad number, a sort of knee and below. What does that tell you?
That's more of a comment on where the device is. And so if it was dropped in a trash can or left in a backpack, that says that's really the seat of the device. I have not heard, but if it's actually sitting on the ground, there should be some cratering in that area if it was on the sidewalk and so forth. And I haven't heard one comment on that in terms of that kind of damage.
Would you assume that from chemical swabs already taken at the site, Jimmy, that authorities know already the nature of the material used in this explosion or not?
Yes, I think they probably already know. If it was smokeless powder, for example, I've shot 130 pipe bombs, and almost always you have very recognizable residue available. If it's a more brisant explosive, like the suggestion C4, you won't see the residue, but it's still there. It becomes a harder problem when you have lots of evidence brought into the forensic lab, and I don't know if these are being processed there at the Mass State Lab, which they certainly could be, or if they're being taken down to Quantico. But if you've got lots of pieces, you have to find the ones that have residue on them. So it's kind of a triage operation.
Our reporter was talking about smokeless gunpowder being sold over-the-counter. What is the over-the-counter use for which that would be sold?
If you're a skeet shooter or other hobby shooter, you would reload, and that's what it would be used for.
Reloading your shotgun shells?
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's very common.
And C4 at the other end of the scale, I mean, that is absolutely not over-the-counter.
Absolutely not. You have to have an explosive license to purchase that, and there's all kinds of regulations about locking it up. So either, now, one thing I haven't mentioned is black powder. I noticed one of your eyewitnesses said he could smell the gunpowder, if you remember that comment.
Yes, he did.
That isn't as indicative as you think it might be, but black powder or black powder simulants are certainly the materials that smell sulfurous to us. On the other hand, we've worked with some homemade explosives that are definitely do not contain a sulfur and are not black powder, and my students describe the smell when we put them off. I don't have a very good sniffer, but they describe it as cap guns.
Guns from childhood, yeah.
Yeah, you have that kind of an odor that's associated with the decomposition gases.
A little sharper than sulfur. Juliet Kayyem, when and if we know the nature of the explosive, how telling will that be? How much do you expect that will turn the investigation as to potential suspects?
Oh, I think it will turn it greatly. Everyone, it will tell the, let's put it this way, if it's quite sophisticated, it will steer us towards probably more foreign or at least organized elements that then will lead the investigation, which it already is, to foreign intelligence sources, allies who might have information. If the less sophisticated, then I think that people's sense would be who has done purchases in the United States? Do we have traces or records of those purchases? And then that leads to a domestic investigation. The tools are relatively the same. The legal standards differ. Foreign intelligence investigations are much more sensitive only because there are many countries that do not want it to be known that they're helping us find their patriots, find their nationals. But so that's sort of why there's a little bit of trickery in terms of how much will be disclosed. And then at that stage, I mean, the investigation rightfully is being led by the FBI. There really is no question about that at this stage. And we'll be using all the assets of Boston Police, Mass State Police, and the JTTF to get the investigation going. And then there will be a trial. You know, if someone is found, then there will be a trial either here or if D.C. asserts jurisdiction. So it unfolds both very quickly, as we've seen, but may be many years before there's resolution.
A beautiful day, a joyful day, and then a shocking day. I want to get our listeners in. Andrea, in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Andrea, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to call and offer one thought. I'm a third-time Boston marathoner. I finished the race about 15 minutes before the blast and had made it to Beacon Street safely, and so was not in any immediate danger. But
yes,
for me, the part that is so jarring about this and so particularly unbearable to imagine is that marathons are the time and are a moment, are an event, an occasion that bring out the best in humanity, and that is why I run them. I run them because complete strangers will come out and offer me orange slices and cheer for me and say, I'm proud of you, and I'll never see them again, but they're there. And they encourage me with respect to our own, you know, our capacity to be good people. And that's why I participate in these events. They're so inspiring. And I think they're almost an unequivocal good in our society, usually.
Yeah.
And so for me, what was particularly devastating about yesterday is to have that attacked. And as a runner, that's how I interpret the attack until we know more, is that it's an attack on the human spirit, and that's just how it feels to me. And I just wanted to share that because I realize, you know, it's not going to help the investigation, but that's how it feels to me as a participant.
Andrea, I am sure that thousands, millions feel exactly the same way. You more vividly, having crossed that finish line just minutes before this blast. But I appreciate your saying that. I mean, it is true. Marathons are expressions of human drive and athleticism and beauty, and all the spectators sharing in this. I mean, up against this, Julia, and maybe it always feels like this, but this felt somehow particularly, I don't know, cheap or low or easy,
yeah,
a kind of casual, cruel violence.
Right, Tom, because it was easy. I mean, that is what seems so cruel about it. I mean, in some ways, you want someone to be, you know, some attacker to try a little harder, right? Get a place that is secure. Everyone knows it's not hard. You know, everyone knows that a marathon is exceptionally open.
And these are kids and families. They're watching their loved ones go across. I mean, they're not protected in any way. And these bombs, I guess is the right word, Jimmy, that they don't even seem like much of bomb. And yet you've got 160 injured, gruesome injuries here. Lives changed forever. And three ended, Jimmy.
This is why, of course, we have to continually worry about bombings. Although we talk about other threats, it's just too easy to make a bomb.
Mm-hmm.
And there are so many soft targets. And we had this kind of discussion in December when we saw school shootings, you know, a soft target. So I certainly understand what you're saying. It seems like, you know, play fair against a fair opponent, and yet guerrilla actions don't do that, if we want to talk about it that way.
Yeah, and of course, we don't want to play in this arena at all. No one wants these kinds of threats to public security, but the juxtaposition, just hard to bear yesterday. Jimmy Oxley, professor of chemistry at the University of Rhode Island, co-director of the Department of Homeland Security Center, on excellence in explosive detection, mitigation, and response. Jimmy, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Juliet Kayyem, do you have a gut feeling? You've been in the Homeland Security business plenty.
Yeah.
When we may begin to get some kind of clearer picture, or could it be, as you say, years?
Well, years until I think there'll be final resolution if there is, in fact, a trial. I'm so reluctant on gut feelings, only because
mm-hmm.
I remember, you know, the gut feeling of Oklahoma City. I remember the gut feeling of the Atlanta bombings. My gut feeling is that something will happen fast within the next 48 hours because the clues are already there. And if we don't hear anything in the next 48 hours, this could be a long slog, not unlike the Atlanta bombings. And that's because, you know, if the pieces don't come together that fast, it just sometimes takes a while.
My other gut feeling is, and I hope this isn't just wishful thinking, I know that sounds horrible in my field, but that this was probably just a sign seemed to point towards domestic. I say that's wishful thinking only because it's easier to deal with in many respects. If we can find a culprit, we put them through the criminal system. And
Juliet Kyan, we've got to let you go right there. I know former Homeland Security Advisor in Massachusetts, Juliet Kyan. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about the bombing of the Boston Marathon, blasts at the finish line, and a sea of unknowns today. We're looking at the investigation, the impact, the implications of what has just happened yesterday. A very sad scene suddenly in the midst of so much joy and beautiful human effort. In a press conference earlier today, Boston Police Commissioner Ed Davis said there are no suspects in custody when talking with reporters.
No one's in custody. Right. No one's in custody.
You all said that there's an individual responsible for this. Does that mean that you're ruling out any group that's responsible for it?
No.
No one in custody. Of course, that doesn't mean there are no persons of interest. This will be followed for days, months, who knows how long. I want to bring in Carrie Watkins right now. She joins us from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. She's executive director of the Oklahoma City National Memorial and Museum, built after the Oklahoma City bombings killed 168 people. She's also organizer of the Oklahoma Memorial City Marathon, scheduled for April 28th. That tracks more than 20,000 runners. It was started in 2001. Carrie Watkins, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Remind us of the origins of your marathon there. It was implemented to memorialize your own bombing.
It was it was created to remember those who were killed, those who survived, and the community changed forever. And it was a race that was created to show acts of courage and resilience. And we stand today with that same mission, and probably even more so because of what you guys are dealing with.
How are you thinking about security after what we've just seen in Boston? Will you make more different arrangements? Or are you already – I mean, how do you secure a marathon?
Well, Tom, that's the big question. We have an emergency management plan. We have a security and safety plan that's been in place since the first year we ran. We've obviously we'll relook at that and continue to examine it as we get more intel out of Boston. But we will have heightened security, as everyone will – following this event, on public events. I mean, we want to reassure people that we'll make this the safest race we know how, and you just have to rely on people to stand together and encourage and say, you know, these terrorists will not defeat us. And it is a terrorist attack, whether domestic or international, at this point is insignificant. It happened, and we have to help Boston heal and help runners know that we cannot allow these terrorists to say, you know, to defeat that freedom that we enjoy.
Oklahoma City, of course, felt just a terrible attack. What is it? Almost was it 19 years
ago? 18 years ago.
Did it change the way Oklahoma City residents participate in public life or not, Carrie?
Well, I think immediately after, yes. I mean, people. But what we saw in Oklahoma City was a strength and a resilience that I have not seen another place since. I mean, it is a terrific tenacity that we just said we are not going to let these terrorists defeat us. And that's a choice people have to make. I mean, it's easiest, you know, the terrorists want to create fear and they want us to go away and hide up in our homes and let them win. And we chose to be opposite here. We built a memorial in their face. We took a stand to say, you know, these people will not be forgotten because of one coward's attack and attitude on our government. Mm. And so that's not going to happen the first day after or the first week after. I mean, it may in Boston, but I mean, people have to have time to heal and to find strength and hope. But at the same time, you know, I think we in Oklahoma City want to reach out to Bostonians and say, we stand with you, united. We have to stand together as a country. If people didn't get to finish the Boston race and they want to finish in Oklahoma City, we'd love to welcome them here with open arms for free in this race to be able to cross the finish line. I mean, that's something we could do together as two cities. And, you know, as I said yesterday to the media, people who ran our race a year ago, more than 80 people ran Boston yesterday. They qualified the Oklahoma City Memorial Marathon. And it was the pinnacle of their racing career to be able to run the streets of Boston. There is no better race. You know, we look up to what Boston does, and for a terrorist to decide to take that freedom and ride away from them is something we cannot tolerate as Americans.
The 117th running of the Boston Marathon yesterday, quite a history there. Oklahoma City coming along with its own, a very tough city in Oklahoma City that went through a deep trial after those attacks 18 years ago. A very tough city in Boston, believe me, a very resilient population as well. Carrie, stand by in Oklahoma. Dave is calling from Corydon, Indiana. Dave, thanks. You're on the air.
Hey, sir. Thank you very much. I just wanted to chime in a little bit. I'm actually a military police officer in the Army Reserves. Mm-hmm. Got 20 years of experience. Spent the last 8 years training folks that were going to Iraq and Afghanistan. And I've noticed that, you know, most of the coverage is talking about, you know, what has happened and how do we, you know, bolster our law enforcement efforts to handle, you know, counterterrorism. And one thing that I wanted to point out is that the Department of Homeland Security adopted a program from New York City called See Something, Say Something.
Yeah.
And you can Google it on the Internet. And basically, it turns every person into a watchdog. You know, when you have, you know, like you said, 26-something miles on a race course, it's impossible to secure that much of a event. So, but you, if you have people along that entire course that are watchful of strangers, watchful of suspicious activity and suspicious vehicles, you know, they can report that to law enforcement. You can field interview folks or check out vehicles. You know, police aren't psychic. Military aren't psychic. You know, we need as much help as we can get to do our thing.
Yes, and of course, the call going out today, Dave, from authorities in Boston for all the video and photographs and all records people may have of the block or blocks around these explosions yesterday, and yet they happened. Explosive sniffing dogs had earlier gone through here. There's been a lot of speculation that these may have been planted later, perhaps in trash cans. You've been a military MP. I mean, even if people are on heightened alert, it happened. Somebody slipped something somewhere that nobody noticed, or at least nobody spoke up about, Dave.
Right, and that's kind of what I'm addressing, is the nobody noticed part of it. You know, obviously, you know, we have to keep our guard up. We can't go over through our lives being paranoid. I teach preparedness and survival and disaster preparedness here in Southern Indiana. I have a cool called SOS Survival School. You know, I teach folks, you know, be alert. Don't be paranoid. Don't be scared to leave your home. But when you're out, you know, watch your surroundings. Pay attention to things. If you have a gut instinct that something's funny, tell somebody. Say, listen, I'll give an example. I was in the in front of a large store in Walmart, in Corydon, I'm sorry, and there was a large white truck parked in front of the store right in the fire lane.
Yeah.
I went into the store. Nobody was in the vehicle. The windows were tinted. It was a box truck. Came back out about 45 minutes later, the vehicle still sitting there. So I went back into the store, said, hey, listen, let me speak to a manager. You know, do we know who this vehicle belongs to? Do you know how long it's been here? This was right after the Newtown shootings, and, you know, this chain store had actually pulled all their what you consider your assault-style weapons. So, you know, someone could do something to make a statement.
Absolutely. See something, say something. It's good advice, and we appreciate you reminding us of it from Indiana. Kerry Watkins, of course, knows how important that is in Oklahoma City. Thank heavens there were no vehicles in this scene yesterday. Whatever was delivered there had to come in relatively small. Dave, I appreciate your call. One more. Joe in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Joe, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just have two quick comments. First comment, I'm actually a student in Juliet's class at Harvard. Uh-huh. And I found the crisis communications to be very effective. I found Ed Davis somewhat relieving, and you know, the fact that the police let us know that they're on the streets in Boston and that they're out there trying to keep us safe, I felt very relieved by that. Second point is this, you know, I'm from Massachusetts and I'm from Boston, and this just feels so personal to me.
Yes.
This area, Boylston Street, is one of my favorite areas in Boston. And actually, one of the explosives blew up right outside one of my favorite restaurants, Abe and Louie's. So this feels so personal. And I served in Afghanistan and I've seen explosions, but I never thought I'd see anything like this in one of my favorite areas of Boston. So it just feels so personal.
Joe, I'm sure there are so many listeners relating to that right now, and myself right at the head of that line. This is a beautiful event. Where I've had my family many, many times right along the raceway, like so many others. It is not one that we want to see in this category of
of threat. Kerry Watkins, stand by in Oklahoma City. I want to welcome to the conversation right now my On Point colleague, Jack Beattie, Boston native, joins us today from Hanover, New Hampshire. Jack, thank you so much for being with us.
Hello, Tom.
Just think with us, Jack, about what this race means to Boston, really more than Boston, and the meaning of a wound, this wound in the midst of this event.
Well, as you say, this goes back to 1897. It has been an amateur pageant all that time up until the 1980s when cash prizes were first awarded. But basically, it's still an amateur race with 20, 30,000 people running. My son ran it twice. And people gather along and cheer each other along. And it's a ceremony of innocence, and I think that, you know, it commemorates an even more important moment in American history, mm-hmm. not just Massachusetts, and that's Patriots Day, when the first shots of the American Revolution were fired.
The shot heard around the world
at Lexington and Concord, mm-hmm. the beginning of the world's first successful anti-colonial war. And the symbolism of that, I mean, next to July 4th, this is sort of the day of American independence, and it's been now defiled. And you ask about the sort of penumbra over this. I mean, the shadow of fear is now forever on this wonderful event. And people say that's exactly what terrorism tries to do, to induce fear. The fear will lead people to distrust each other, break the bonds of citizenship, sanction more authoritarian government at the worst, and that it's a corrosive element in our free democratic society.
Corrosive, but we do not have to bend to all that. Kerry Watkins, you do realize in a moment like this how much we depend on community goodwill when we put on big public events of whatever kind, Kerry.
Well, you depend on community goodwill. You depend on these law enforcement and first responders to be at bay, you know, protecting, watching, keep an eye out. I think as we wrestle with the decision as to what to do, which your instinct is, yes, by God, we'll run it, you also have to keep in mind the responsibility you have of putting 24,000 runners on the streets and equally that many or more along the streets cheering these runners on. Mm-hmm. And you know, that's not a decision I went to bed lightly with last night. I mean, it is, our race includes, you know, small children too, because we have a kids marathon, and you have to keep all that in consideration. And I think, you know, without a doubt, we want this race to carry on. We would love for people from Boston to be here with us to finish the race. But at the same time, we're depending on the police department, the FBI, the Joint Terrorism Task Force, the Homeland Security, all those folks to keep us safe.
And each other.
And he's right. You're counting on people to see something, say something. I mean, this incident we're dealing with in Oklahoma City 18 years ago, had McVeigh's friends knew about what was going on, you know, called the FBI, we wouldn't even be here discussing it. I mean, people around have an idea, and that will come out over the next 48, 72 hours. I believe the law enforcement will find out what happened, and they've got to be very careful in their approach, but you also have to let them do their work. And, you know, it will be critical to the community to stand together, united, and to say, you know, this will not stop the Boston Marathon. It's too big. It's too important of a race for our country, and to let one act of senseless terrorism defeat us.
As you say, people around Timothy McVeigh in the Oklahoma City case could have raised an alarm. There must be people who know something now about what happened here, and we hope authorities will hear from them. I want to go to Hopkinton, Massachusetts, where the Boston Marathon begins, the other end of that 26.2 miles. Anne is calling. Hi, Anne. Thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Uh-huh.
I just want to say that I've been a resident of Hopkinton for 16 years, and the event of Boston Marathon is the biggest day of the year in that town. And my neighbors and friends and I are all heartbroken by what happened yesterday, but as your previous callers have talked about, we have community spirit. We're tough. We're New Englanders. We're resilient. The marathon, I believe, will go on. We'll all be more watchful, probably a little more hesitant to just stand in huge groups at the starting line, as we always have, but I think that as your previous callers just said, we can't give up. We can't hide.
I couldn't agree more, and I appreciate your calling in from Hopkinton. Jack, you called it a ceremony of innocence. There is power in ceremonies of innocence. They express an ideal of what we want our community to be, of the kind of society we want to inhabit. We can't walk away entirely from ceremonies of innocence and keep that model, that vision in front of us, that reality.
No, we can't. And, of course, ceremony of innocence, as I think of it now, is a phrase from a Yeats poem where he says, the ceremony of innocence is drowned in blood. And I think that's what we saw, and we saw, of course, in Newtown as well. And you know, this is how the fabric of daily life changes. This woman just said, Anne just said, well, maybe we won't stand so closely together at the start line next year. That's a change.
Yeah, that crowd is an expression of joy.
Yes, yes. But, you know, if people are standing further apart to be safe, that's already changed something basic in the way we live here. And, you know, it's strange. When you look at World War II, there wasn't much change in daily life in terms of reacting to the enemy. Already in our cities, at our airports, and now in our future marathons, there are going to be changes in how we run these things just because of the marathon, really, of this struggle against terrorism.
Kerry Watkins, will you be there at the starting line of the Oklahoma Memorial City Marathon on April 28th?
I will. I kick it off. And we observe 168 seconds of silence for those who were killed in the Oklahoma City bombing, and we'll tack on a few seconds for the folks in Boston. And we will... you know, as it stands today, we will be there, and we expect the streets to be full, and we'll have the right procedures in place, and we will take the necessary precautions. But I mean, we have to continue to stand together and say this will not define us or defeat us.
Kerry Watkins in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, executive director of the Oklahoma City National Memorial and Museum, and organizer of the big marathon coming right up there. Kerry, good luck to you. Best of luck for a beautiful marathon. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks. Let us know if we can help anyone there.
Thank you very much, Kerry. And Jack, we know Boston. We know it is one tough city. We know it is a resilient city, even in the face of this. It goes deep, and I have no doubt that it's already come to the fore, Jack.
Yes, it has. And already the emphasis is on the people who helped and the people who sacrificed and the people who buoyed others' morale. That's the Boston we all treasure.
Let's do that. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.